How's your hearing? One of the struggles of aging is your hearing starts to deteriorate a little bit. But I would suggest worse than that is so does listening. See, there's a difference between hearing and listening. Hearing is the ability to capture sound waves. Listening is the willingness to take the sound waves and to process them and to act upon them. So let me change the question. How's your listening? I don't know if you do the riddles, the mind things that try and keep your mind sharp. I've done those on and off, and I came across one a while ago. It went something like this. You're driving a bus, and you drive 12 miles east, and you pick up 8 children. You drive another 3 miles east, then you go 4 miles north, you drop off 2 and pick up 6. You drive 7 miles back west. What's the age of the driver? I must admit, when I went through it the first time, I was a little flummoxed. I didn't know. See, the point of a riddle is to try and distract you from the important thing. The age of the driver is 53. See, I, in that illustration, was the driver, and so were you, so the age differs. But the reality is that so much of life distracts us from hearing what's really important, that we don't always listen. We're coming this morning to the book of 1 Samuel, and I think to a large degree, 1 Samuel chapter 3 and verse 1 summarizes the period of time that we're looking at. That God had spoken, and they refused to listen. And so God came to the point where he just didn't speak. We're making our way through the Bible this year. As we're going through these 66 books, we come to the 9th stop on our tour, and we're in 1 Samuel. But if I could just take a couple seconds, because we're going to enter a new part of Israel's history. We began back in January looking at the book of Genesis and how God created everything and placed Adam and Eve in the garden and gave them a choice. You can choose my good or your own good. They unfortunately chose their own good and set in motion this horrific set of events where eventually they'd be thrown out of the garden. The whole world would be destroyed. God would start again with Noah, and we continue. We watch as Israel ends up at the end of the book of Genesis in Egypt, and then in Exodus they come out of Egypt, and we watch as God once again gives them the opportunity to choose his good, but they choose their own. We then come to the book of Judges, and the book of Judges follows on the heels of this great point, maybe the high point of the entire nation of Israel, as they enter the land, as everyone obeys. But soon everyone is doing what is right in their own eyes, and we see this downward spiral. But we do get one glimpse. If you were here last week, we looked at the book of Ruth, and Ruth becomes this incredible testimony to the goodness that was still there during the theocracy. This morning, we're moving to a new section. We're going to leave where God was the king, and we're going to move into the monarchy. Eventually, Israel is going to get this king. As we look at it, it's interesting that the monarchy is where most of the writing in the Old Testament takes place. The book of Psalms, for the most part, will be written under David and several of the other kings. Obviously, the book of Proverbs, written by the second king, Solomon, as well as the Song of Solomon. Most of the Old Testament prophets will be written during this time as well. We do still have one part of history left, and that is going to be the post-exilic time. Israel will go off and come back. But this morning, we start this new era, this monarchy, with 3 books. Now, in the English translation, you have 6 books, but in the Hebrew translation, there really only are 3 books. There's been a lot of discussion as to why we have 6 rather than 3. The best solution that I came across is a few years before Christ, the Jews no longer spoke Hebrew, so the Bible was translated into Greek from Hebrew. It takes about 30% more space to write Greek than it does Hebrew. Hebrew has no vowels. They just put little points and dashes. And so the idea, the thought is that the scrolls just became too large, and so they split them in half. I was tempted to try and get through the book of Samuel, the book of Kings, and the book of Chronicles in one Sunday, but we won't do that. We'll split up. We'll stick with the 6 books. The book of Samuel really is the beginning of the monarchy. We're going to see that transition from the end of the Judges with Samuel until the first king, Saul. The book of Kings really does provide the look at the end of the monarchy. The book of Chronicles is kind of interesting because it actually covers the entire time of the monarchy. Some have suggested that Samuel and Kings are a prophet's view of Israel's history. The book of Chronicles is a priest's view of history. But this morning we come to 1 Samuel, and 1 Samuel is one of the books that are filled with many of the stories that you know. It's filled with three great men. There's, first of all, Samuel. Samuel literally means heard of God, and I think you could even translate it the other way, that he hears God. We come to Saul, the humanly speaking, perfect king. And then finally, we'll come to David. But we begin in chapter 1 with this amazing individual. We're introduced by Hannah's great prayer. This past week, Paul's speaking for me next Saturday. I've got next Sunday. He might be speaking Saturday too. I'm not sure. But he'll be here Sunday. I've got a wedding on Saturday, full weekend. And so he's going to be taking 2 Samuel. And we've been talking back and forth. And he asked me a question that kind of caught me off guard. He asked, when do you think Israel realized Jesus was coming, Messiah was coming? And I have to be honest, I never really thought about that. But as we unfold the story, we know the way the story begins, God puts this couple in the perfect environment, and he wants to bless them, he wants to provide for them, he wants to be with them, but unfortunately they choose their way rather than his, and we enter this period of death, destruction, and pain. And as that begins, there's this promise that a seed of the woman will crush the head of the serpent. And then to a large degree, that promise just kind of hangs there. And it's not really picked up for quite a while. We'll move forward, and eventually in chapter 12, God will choose Abraham, and he will refine it a little bit. He will say that all the world will be blessed through you. And we look back on that and see that he clearly was talking about the Messiah. I don't know what they understood. You move forward to chapter 49. As Jacob is blessing his sons, he will say, and Judah will produce a king who will reign forever. And then it just kind of drops. In fact, it drops until 1 Samuel chapter 2. The very first word of first use of the word Messiah is in 1 Samuel chapter 2 and verse 10. You say, where is it? He will give strength to his king and exhort the horn of his Messiah. See, the Messiah was one that was clearly chosen. I think to some degree they might have thought it was Saul, and then they had hoped it was David. And probably throughout the reign of the monarchy, they kept hoping that the anointed one would come. But by the time we come to the prophets, it becomes abundantly clear that no human will ever suffice. No man will ever be able to do what is desperately needed. And the prophet Isaiah particularly will become consumed with this prediction of the anointed one that will come, the one who is the mighty God, the everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. But I think that first image of Messiah begins right here with the prayer of Hannah. Samuel is an amazing individual, and I wish we had more time to focus in on him, but we're just trying to get through the book. We come to chapter 3, and I don't know for sure. Hebrew tradition says Samuel wrote the book of Samuel, but there is a little struggle with that because he's going to die less than halfway through it, so he obviously didn't write the second half. Unless he had far clearer prophecy than I'm going to give him credit for. I don't know who wrote it, but it certainly is a master author, because look at the imagery that he paints. As Samuel enters the tabernacle, the boy ministered there, and in those days the Lord was rare. The word of the Lord was rare. There were not many visions. One night, Eli, whose eyes were becoming weak, that he could barely see, was lying down in his usual place. The lamp of God had not quite yet gone out. He's painting this picture of every single morning as they would open the tabernacle, the light, the menorah, was required to keep burning, but there was always the wonder, did we have a big enough candle? Would the light go out? And we opened the tabernacle hoping there was still light to be found. It is almost as if the author is trying to say God's light to Israel was flickering, and it was almost out, and then God spoke to Samuel. Samuel becomes this incredible illustration of a man who, though he lived in these horrible days, remember in the Hebrew Bible here last week, I suggested that in the Hebrew Bible, the book of Ruth follows the book of Proverbs. And so you come right out of this whole horrific time of the judges in which everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And then Samuel shows up. And in fact, he becomes this incredible transition from the judges, these wicked men, this wicked time, to provide a place where God would provide a national leader. And thus, Samuel is given the incredible chance to choose a king. And it says, so all the elders of the Lord gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah, and they said to him, you are old. Your sons do not walk in your ways. It's interesting that if you look back at Eli, I don't know what to make of Eli. There are some good things, but it seems as if the overriding thing you will remember about Eli is he couldn't control his sons. Samuel does many good things, but he seems to have picked up the poor parenting habit from his adopted dad, Eli. And they say, we don't want your sons. We want a king, but not just any king. We want a king just like everyone else. It amazes me how we are so controlled by people that we don't even necessarily like. You know the whole expression, you spend money you don't have to impress people you don't like? It seems to be a reality. There's this pressure on all of us to conform to the world. And it certainly couldn't be said that the nations around Israel had some stellar record. The kings were self-absorbed, proud, arrogant men. But Israel thought, wouldn't it be nice to have a king just like them? And so God gives them their request. May I suggest that 1 Samuel chapter 8, to me, is one of the scariest passages in all the Bible? Because God answers the prayer, even though it was not in their best interest. Be honest, you ever prayed something that years later you thank God he didn't answer? I am so thankful for many of the prayers that I have prayed that God simply said no, and at the time they were devastating. And as I look back on it, all I can say is thank you. This time God answers, and they get Saul. And Saul was an impressive man. He was exactly what they were looking for. But once again, some imagery here. Do you remember how the book of Judges ends? The book of Judges ends with this terrible story of a man traveling with his mistress. They come to a city by the name of Gibeah. Chapter 10 and verse 26 says it's the very same city that Saul happened to live in. And he stops there, and all of the people gather around the house that he's staying at and say, send the man out. We want to have sex with him. And they say, you can't do that. That's terrible. Here's my daughter. Here's the mistress. Rape them. And so they spend all night raping them, and by morning, the mistress is dead. The man is so enraged that he cuts her up in little pieces and sends her to all of the 11 other tribes. And the 11 tribes come to the tribe of Benjamin and says, give us the men. They must be punished. And Benjamin says, for what? So they raped a mistress. Come on, it's not like they did anything wrong. Really? That's where Israel is. That's where Benjamin is. That's the tribe, the city that Saul will come from. I don't know exactly what to make of it, but I think it's a little ironic that they choose a king from a tribe who thought raping a mistress was perfectly acceptable. But after all, he looked great. He was a full head taller than everybody else. He was a man's man. He was a guy's guy. He was exactly what you could hope for in an individual. Unfortunately, he was so impressive, he began to impress himself. In fact, we don't have time this morning, or we're not going to take the time to go through the life of Saul, but it is one of the most discouraging downward spirals of a man who gets caught up thinking that his definition of good was sufficient. Let me just pick one illustration. In chapter 13, you have this story in which Saul gathers his troops. There's 6,000 people gathered together to go to war against the Philistines. As he waits, people begin to get scared. The Philistines have thousands of chariots, tens of thousands of men, and his 6,000 army begins to dwindle, and he begins to get down to the place where there's only a few left. Do you remember any stories of a leader who watched the troops dwindle to go against a massively overpowered and substantially larger troop than they were, Saul doesn't learn the lesson of Gideon. In fact, what he does is he decides he needs to reinterpret it. Oh, I need a good luck charm. God, I need your help. I'm going to offer you a sacrifice. I'll wait for Samuel to come. But then after 7 days, when Samuel's not there, Saul says, I waited. I guess it's time for me to go ahead and sacrifice. He begins the sacrifice, and Samuel shows up, and he says, Saul, what are you doing? And Saul replies, when I saw that the men were scattering and that you did not come at the set time and that the Philistines were assembling at Michmash, I thought, now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I've not sought the Lord's favor. So I felt compelled to offer the burnt offering. Come on, God, it's reasonable. I needed to offer a sacrifice. Samuel doesn't show up, so come on, I'm just doing the natural thing. You will watch this pattern in Saul's life in which he's very willing to reinterpret God's instructions to make sense to him. You ever done that? You know what God says, but it's just not really convenient. I'm not, I'm offering a sacrifice. That's a good thing, right? So the Mosaic Law specifically says it has to be a priest. I'm the king. Isn't that good enough? And Saul hears from Samuel that because you have chosen this route, the kingdom has been taken from you. You acted foolishly, Samuel said. You have not kept the command the Lord your God gave you. If you had, he would have established your kingdom over Israel for all time. But now your kingdom will not endure. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart. And Samuel tells Saul, God's putting you aside. We fast forward a couple chapters and we come to chapter 15, and there's another command by God, kill everybody. And Saul kills everybody but the king. God says, destroy all their property. He destroyed most of their property, and Samuel shows up, and Saul says, I did everything God said. And Samuel says, what's that sound of bleeding in my ear I hear? We just kept the best of the sheep to sacrifice to God. And Samuel says, Saul, you don't get to reinterpret God's commands. Now the kingdom has been yanked away from you. In chapter 16, we're introduced to what I am convinced was the king God had always wanted Israel to have. In fact, as you go back to the book of Deuteronomy, you will find that it was in God's plans to give Israel a king. It had always been his desire for them to be led, but it was the kind of king that was important. In chapter 15 and 16, I really believe you get the heart of the whole book of 1 Samuel. You're introduced to this, well, let's be honest, not very impressive individual. So unimpressive, his dad's not even impressed. In verse 6, Samuel comes, and as soon as he sees Eliab, that's the oldest, it's the tallest, it's the strongest, it's the best looking of the bunch, Samuel says, surely the Lord's anointed is before him. And the Lord said to Samuel, do not look on his appearance or on his height or his stature, because I have rejected him, for the Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. It amazes me how much time and energy is spent on the outward appearance. I came across a couple of surveys. There was a survey done several years ago of people who went to gyms. And the simple question was, why do you go? For health benefits or so you look better? Guess which won the contest? The majority wanted to look better. They, a few years ago, surveyed freshmen coming into college. And they said, if you could change any one thing, what would you change? Now, I realize it's asking a little bit too much for them to say, I would change my holiness. I would like to be more committed to God. But you would expect some of them to say, I would like to be a little smarter. I would like to have a little more money. I would like to have a little more influence. 90% of the students surveyed said, I'd like to change something about my physical appearance so I look better. The majority of the guys wanted to be taller. The majority of the girls wanted to be thinner. And all of them wanted to be acne-free. But before you rip on the poor teenagers, the whole beauty industry is a multi-billion-dollar industry in which Billions of dollars every year are spent for the perfect eyeshadow, are spent to take in here and let out there. We as a society are obsessed with how we look externally. Did you look in the mirror this morning? In fact, one of the questions that always I struggle with is, I wonder where you spent more time before you came to church, and how you look or how your heart was prepared to hear God's word. Now, please, don't hear me to say, next Sunday I want you to come without showering, shaving, or combing your hair. That's not what I'm saying. There's nothing wrong with giving care to our physical appearance. But I fear that too often we get obsessed with how we look. Samuel, the great man of God, Samuel, said, clearly Eliab must be the guy. And God says, nope. In fact, to me, one of the hardest parts of this whole story is Samuel comes. Now, we don't know for sure what was told to him. Obviously, if you go back and read this story, he's trying to keep it a secret because if Saul finds out, it's not going to go well for Samuel or probably for Jesse and his boys. And so there's some ambiguity as to exactly what he's doing. Did they know he was choosing the next king? Did they think he was just choosing the next prophet? I don't know what they thought Samuel was showing up for. But Samuel says, bring your sons. And he brings seven of them. If you went back to the end of the book of Ruth, we didn't spend any time on it last week, but at the end of the book of Ruth, the women of the community say to Naomi, Ruth is as good to you as seven sons. That kind of goes over our head, but in the Hebrew culture, seven is a number of completion, of perfection. The perfect home was home to seven sons. Who wants eight? Jesse didn't. In fact, Jesse didn't even bring his youngest son to meet the prophet. Clearly, there's no way God could be interested in him. In fact, Samuel says, is there any more? And Jesse says, okay, I got one. But he stinks. Okay, I'm reading a little bit between the lines. It says, are they all here? And he says, there's the youngest. It's actually, there's the smallest. But behold, he's keeping the sheep. Now, I'm guessing the vast majority of you have spent some time in a hog confinement building, a milking parlor. You've been around animals where they're in a confined space. What happens to you when you walk into a hog confinement building? It always amazes me, the few times I've done it, is it takes a little while, like days, to get the smell out of your hair. I don't even try and get it out of my clothes. This is a world where water wasn't common. There's no way David would have had time to wash. Living with sheep was a stinky, smelly proposition. He said, you can't possibly want him. He stinks. But Samuel says, we're not going to sit down until you bring him. And as soon as he comes, we find this amazing boy who has all of these strikes against him. He only has one thing going for him, and it's his heart. Stephen, in Acts chapter 7, as he's recounting the history of Israel, he comes to the story of David, and in verse 22 he says, and when he had removed him, speaking of God removing Saul, he raised up David to be their king, of whom he testified and said, I have found in David, the son of Jesse, a man after my heart. So the question ought to come, what does a man after my heart look like? We'll get there in a second, but there's part of the story that I must admit I've missed. One of the things I am struggling a little bit as we're going through this study, because there's just so much material to cover, but one of the things I've really enjoyed is I've seen some things from 30,000 feet I didn't see from ground level. And this is one of these. It says at the end of this story, so Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the presence of his brothers. From that day on, the Spirit of the Lord came upon him. Let me go to chapter 17 just for a second. David is brought into Saul's tent, and Saul is going to say to David, you can't face the giant. And what is David's response? In verse 34, it says, but David said to him, your servant has been keeping his sheep his father's sheep when a lion or a bear came and carried off a sheep from the flock. And I went after him and I struck it and rescued the sheep from its mouth. When it turned on me, I seized it by its hair and struck it and killed it. And I must admit, every time I've ever come to that story, I've thought, wow, that must have been an amazing individual. Have you heard to this point the story of anybody else all by himself being attacked by a lion and tearing him apart? This is Samson. It's not that David was this amazing shepherd boy. It was that David served an amazing God. And when the lion attacked, it didn't stand a chance because the Spirit of the Lord came upon him in power. See, I think this is David living the life of Samson. But Samson got to do it once with a lion. David got to do it with a lion and a bear and who knows how many other animals. Because the Spirit of the Lord was upon David. And so we come to chapter 17, and I am convinced that the story of David and Goliath, while undoubtedly the best-known story of all the book of 1 Samuel, maybe the best-known story of the entire Old Testament, is entirely misunderstood. It's not a story of the underdog winning. It's not a story of if you just face your giants, you will be surprised at how much you can accomplish. It has nothing to do with any of that. It's a story to illustrate what the heart of God is looking for. What he's looking for is somebody who refuses to look on the external and is consumed with the glory and the grandeur of his God. The story opens, and we don't have time to read the whole story, but let me just pick out a few highlights. It says in verse number 4, "And there came out from the camp the Philistines, a champion of Goliath of Gath, who was 6 cubits in a span." Now, we don't use the measurement cubits very often. It's from your elbow to your tip. The problem is that if you go back to ancient history, you'll find that there was a whole mess of different cubits. In fact, the Hebrews had 2 different cubits. They had a short cubit and a long cubit. The Egyptians also had 2 cubits. And so a cubit could be anywhere from 17 and a half inches to 20.6. I measured mine a while back. Mine is almost exactly 18. And that's what's used to get to the 9'6" if you have one of the more modern. But how tall is 9'6"? If you were here several years ago, I threw this picture up. Now, my son gave me permission to use this as long as I told you he's no longer 5'1". He has grown a little bit, but ancient history, the average height of an adult male in Israel was someplace around 5'1 or 5'2". David is still a boy. So he's probably even shorter than that. But how tall is 5'1"? Well, I just picked the biggest guy that I'm familiar with. I know Shaquille O'Neal no longer plays in the NBA, but he's still a recognizable name. He comes in at 7'2". At 5'1", you would get to just a little over his waist. 9'9" absolutely dwarfs 5'1". In fact, if you simply were looking at David going up against Goliath, there's no comparison. If all you look at is what you see with your eyes. In fact, the author, whoever it is that's writing it, has a bunch of other parts of the story. He wears this coat of mail, this state-of-the-art technological protection. It weighs approximately 125 pounds. If you go into the military, I'm told a rucksack weighs about 70 pounds, so twice the size of a normal rucksack. He then comes to this amazing spear that he has between his shoulder blades. It has on the head of it a head that weighs about the same size of a modern shot put. What you see in front of you is this amazing monster of a man. And he begins to throw out these insults. He stood and he shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why have you come to draw up for battle? Am I not a Philistine? And are you not slaves of Saul? Choose a man for yourself and let him come down to me. If he's able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us." And the Philistines said, "I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." And as he was talking with them, Goliath, the champion, came out, and in these words of defiance, he throws out these insults, and it's amazing what people saw. They saw Goliath. David heard him. David wasn't using his eyes. He was using his heart. And I would suggest to you that the story of David and Goliath is the story of the greatest underdog in history. You had a 9-foot nothing taken on the God of the universe. Who are you going to be? Think that's successful. In fact, David says, who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? And as they come out, the words of David were spoke, and he says to Saul, I don't want your hearts to be troubled. And finally, there's this grand confrontation, and the Philistine moved forward and came to David with his shield in front of him. And when the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth, ruddy and handsome in appearance. And the Philistine said to David, am I a dog that you come at me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and to the beasts of the field. Then David said to the Philistine, you come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you defy. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down, and I will cut off your head, and I will give your dead body to the hosts and the Philistines this day, to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that David was a great warrior. David wasn't concerned about himself at all. He wanted two things. He wanted the world to know there was a God, and he wanted all of God's people to know that God doesn't save by external means. What God is looking for is not physically impressive people. He's looking for people who are willing to trust him. A giant? Come on, are you serious? God spoke the universe into existence. A giant is an obstacle. But the question is, where are your eyes focused? David would live a life consumed by the grandeur and the glory of God. We don't have time to continue the rest of the book, but the rest of this book is this struggle as Saul seeks to kill David, and David continues to trust his God. The sad part of the story, you come to 2 Samuel chapter 11. And in 2 Samuel chapter 11, it says, and David looked and saw Bathsheba. And it was all over. I wonder this morning, where are your eyes focused? It doesn't take an awful lot to overwhelm most of us. We live in a world that is filled with some really hard circumstances. And if our eyes are focused on the external, failure is certain. But David refused to look on the outside. And he was consumed with the grandeur and the greatness of his God. And David was a great man, not because of his abilities, but because rather than looking at others and circumstances, he was consumed with God. The question I can't help but leave you with this morning is, where are your eyes focused? On the world around you or on the God who made the world? Father, we bow in your presence this morning, and I know that there are so many more stories that could be shared, so many great lessons from Samuel, but I do pray that we would learn the lesson of a small shepherd boy who refused to look at the externals, but focused on your grandeur and your greatness. God, I pray this week, as the trials come, help us to keep our eyes on you, and then we will praise you and thank you. For it is in your Son's holy and precious name we pray. Amen. Thank you very much. Have a great day.